Welcome to Case of the Sunday Scaries. I'm Elise, and this is the second episode in my old Hollywood series. And if, like me, you have a fascination with this time period, then you're definitely going to want to check out the first in the series, the episode about the mysterious death of Natalie Wood. And today, my goodness, do I have a story. The 1950 Academy Awards were meant to be a night of celebration, especially for Lana Turner, who was nominated for her first Academy Award for Best Actress. Instead, the evening of glitz and glamour ended in an assault at the Beverly Hills Hotel. And just days later, the police were called to the home of a Hollywood legend, where a mobster lay dead in the bedroom and the most unlikely person was claiming to be the killer. But perhaps, like the shiny veneer of Hollywood, things aren't quite as they seem. But I'll leave it up to you guys to decide what you believe. Before we dive in, I want to give a warning that this case will have discussion about intimate partner violence, self-harm, and sexual assault. Julia Jean Turner was a woman of modest beginnings. She was born February 8, 1921 in Idaho to her working-class parents, John and Mildred Turner. Julia's father, John, was charming. But in 1930, when Julia was just 9 years old, her father's charm had run out, and Julia would get her first understanding of true heartbreak when John would be found dead, murdered, and left on the street. This is a crime that remains unsolved today. If you ask her, her understanding is that after a game of cards, he had won a little bit too much, and someone was not very happy to have to pay their debt. This was the Depression era, and her mom, Mildred, she was a hairstylist, and she did her best to try to keep a roof over their heads, but there was just not enough money for her to care for Julia. So she made the most difficult decision a mom could ever make, I imagine, and decided to put Julia into foster care temporarily. Unfortunately, Julia's tragedies had just begun, because while still grieving the loss of her father and now forced to live without her mother in this new place with strangers, the people that were entrusted to care for Julia began abusing her. But Mildred was not having any of this, and as soon as she heard what was happening, she came and scooped up Julia, and in a beat-up old car, they headed to California to start a new life for themselves. Did Julia dream of stardom? We don't know, but after relocating to California when she was barely a teen, Julia had one of those serendipitous moments of being in exactly the right place at the right time for her fate to come a-knockin'. When Julia walked into the Top Hat malt shop with friends, which, by the way, she was only there because she was skipping school because she didn't want to go to typing class, a talent scout was mesmerized by her beauty and wanted to work with her. And by the age of just 16, Warner Brothers Studio would be signing her for her first contract. Like most actresses do, she had to start out in smaller roles, but Julia, well, you can't say that she didn't take advantage of the opportunity given to her, because in her very first role, she played, of all things, a murder victim in the movie They Won't Forget. And not to use a bad pun here, but the men who saw this film certainly did not forget her. It wasn't necessarily Julia's acting that would be remembered. It was the fact that she wore a tight sweater, and when she walked down the street, she strutted, and it got the attention of everyone. And I'm only mentioning this tight sweater because that would become Julia's nickname in Hollywood for a while, the Sweater Girl. The studio changed her name to Lana Turner, and seemingly overnight, she was a sex symbol and a star.
He knew I had a body as any other teenager, but you see it on a big screen, and really, I wanted to die out of embarrassment. But I'd never seen myself walk before. But I had a brassiere on. People swear I didn't, but I did.
That's what started Sweater Girl.
Obviously, thanks to Mr. Walter Winchell, who claims that he named me America's sweater sweetheart. Big deal. Sex was never really me. It was the public image. And I admit that I'm sure I've disappointed a few gentlemen in bed because I didn't turn out to be whatever the hell they expected. I wasn't the real hotsy-totsy broad, you know?
While the role of ingenue was foreign to Lana, she quickly realized that she enjoyed the attention it brought from the high-profile men and the access it gave her to the parties and the glitz and the glam of Hollywood at the time. You don't have to be a fan of this time period or the movies that came out of it to recognize some of the names in Lana's Little Black Book. Ronald Reagan. Ever heard of him? I forgot he started out as an actor, but he became president later. Howard Hughes, Frank Sinatra, Clark Gable, and some other very notable names of the time. Lana loved a party. Writing in her autobiography, Lana, the Lady, the Legend, and the Truth, which I am currently reading, and my goodness, I wish I could do a transatlantic accent because to quote her without one seems to be a disservice. Lana said, "How I'd love to dress up and go dancing with a handsome dark man. Ciro's was a favorite haunt. The head waiter would spring forward, ah, Miss Turner, and escort me right in. I had a special table right by the stairs so I could watch the comings and goings. I'd head straight there, never a glance to the left or to the right. Once I was seated, I'd give the room a long casing, bowing to this one or blowing that one a kiss. Silly, I guess, but it was fun." I mean, can we start talking like this again? Lana knew how to work a room, and the men, they loved Lana, and Lana loved them right back. She said, "I find men terribly exciting, and any girl who says she doesn't is an anemic old maid, a streetwalker, or a saint." I just enjoy how she talks so much. Lana loved love. Perhaps she was seeking to fill the space that her father's death had left. She married her first of seven, yes, seven husbands after their very first date. They had co-starred in a movie together, and on the evening of their first date, swept up in the moment, the two boarded a flight to Vegas and eloped.
"Now I think I was trying to get even with somebody else because I didn't even know the man. I didn't like him. I certainly wasn't in love with him, but he painted a picture of a little white cottage with a picket fence, getting out of the business. I said, that's what I want. He said, are you kidding? I said, no. He said, you mean if I ask you right now, would you say yes? And I said, try me. And he said, will you marry me? And I said, yes. We drove up to his house up in the mountains. He called Paul Mance. We hired a plane. We flew to Las Vegas. First time we kissed was in the plane taking off.
After you'd agreed to get married?
After, yes. We didn't even kiss in the car when I said yes. It was in the plane taking off that we had, and then a gentle little kiss like that. That was it.
Of course, that romance ended almost as swiftly as it began. Lana said that about 3 days in, she knew it wasn't going to work. Her second husband, Steve Crane, well, she tried to learn a lesson because she waited a week this time. It was 7 days after first meeting him that she again boarded a flight to elope. There was a wee little problem with this marriage, though. Steve hadn't finalized his divorce from his wife. So 4 months later, their marriage had to be annulled. Little bit of a problem, though, because Lana found out she was pregnant. So now facing possible bigamy, they had to make sure that this divorce happened real quick so that he could marry Lana so she wouldn't have an illegitimate child, which would have been a huge problem with the studios.
And he was also not divorced from the wife.
Well, that I only found out after I'd announced to the world that I was pregnant. Then I find out that he's not legally divorced. Then I have to go to court and get an annulment. Otherwise, I could have been sued for bigamy. And still, the baby is growing inside. And so I got the annulment. Now I have an illegitimate child. I mean, that was a mess.
Later that year, when Steve was able to divorce his wife and Lana was pregnant with his child, they had a wedding redo. So she actually had seven husbands, but eight weddings. Lana had always wanted to be a mother. But doctors delivered some pretty horrible news. She had Rh negative blood, which is extremely rare. And if you're a conspiracy theorist right now, I bet your eyes are bugging out and you have your own ideas about what this means. But for Lana, it meant that she was at a high risk of fetal anemia, which would make it incredibly difficult to carry a child to term. The doctor told her that she should have an abortion, but Lana wasn't hearing it. And miracle upon miracles, in July of 1943, Lana and Steve welcomed their baby girl, Cheryl Christina Crane, into the world. It truly was a miracle because Cheryl was born with something called erythroblastosis fetalis, I believe it's called. This is a life-threatening condition that happens when a mom has Rh-negative blood and gives birth to a baby with Rh-positive. Because the mom's body will develop an immune system reaction to the baby, it produces these antibodies that destroy the baby's red blood cells. With where they were at during this time period, as far as their medical understanding of this condition, it's truly a miracle that Cheryl survived. And really tragically, despite multiple future pregnancies, Cheryl would remain the only living child of Lana Turner. Lana's career, like so many starlets of the time, had its peaks and its valleys. But in 1951, after multiple flop movies, facing financial crisis, broken marriages, and pregnancies that ended in stillborn children, miscarriages, and abortion, Lana tried to end her life. She was luckily saved when her business manager broke into the locked bathroom and called for first responders. Thankfully, Lana recovered, and with many situations in her life, she kept a lot of this personal struggle private and continued pursuing her career and love. While there's no criminal record of what we're going to talk about next, Cheryl said that Lana's third husband, an actor named Lex Barker, I believe he played Tarzan, Cheryl says that he assaulted her when she was just 10 years old and continued to assault her throughout the marriage to her mother. She recalls disassociating during the experiences, but after confiding in her friends and grandmother, they encouraged her to finally tell her mom. And again, there is no criminal record of this, it's all alleged, but I think the story from Cheryl of what happened after she told her mom about the abuse is incredibly important to help contextualize what will happen later in this story. Cheryl said when she finally told her mom about the violent sexual abuse that had been happening, Lana returned home, grabbed a gun, and put it to her sleeping husband's head and demanded he leave the house immediately. And I think we can all applaud Lana in this moment. But Lex was not ready to give up that quickly. A few weeks later, Cheryl said that Lex Barker ran up to them while they were in a parking lot, reached his hand through the window, and took a hold of the steering wheel of the vehicle. The next scene plays out like a film. Lana looked him straight in the eyes and said, "I am pulling out of here, and if you don't let go, I'm going to run you over." She hesitated for just a moment, but when his eyes focused over to her daughter, she pushed down on the gas pedal and dragged him for several feet until she slammed the brakes to send him tumbling to the concrete. In Cheryl's words, "We then sped away, and he shrank to a tiny figure, dusting himself off, intently watching our flight." Let's be real here. Lana was a busy actress. She had nannies for Cheryl when she was filming, attending award shows, etc. And perhaps she wasn't the doting hands-on mom. But when she needed to be, she didn't question her daughter. She left that man and made sure to show him she meant business. And while we can all collectively agree that she deserves her Mother's Day flowers for that, we also need to pause at this point in the story and consider Cheryl. She was just a young girl, a child, and was being repeatedly attacked by a man in her own home, a place where she should feel the safest. Then she saw a pretty swift, I suppose you could even say violent, response from her mom, and it worked. The man was no longer in the home abusing her, and he stayed away from that point forward. And I just want you to hold this story in your pocket for a little bit later. I should note that Lana never mentioned this period or the abuse in her own biography or in the many interviews I watched. But considering the generation she was from, and especially with the influence of the studios who held power over her future, it's understandable that involving police would bring media attention to the two actors. So perhaps she thought, or was told by the studios, it was best to keep the police out of it. We're going to pause Lana's story here because I need to introduce you to a new character. John Stompanato Jr. was born October 25th, 1925, to Italian-American parents John Sr. and Carmela, which I love that name. Tragically, just a few days after his birth, his mom Carmela would pass away. John enlisted in the U.S. Army and met his first wife while stationed overseas. They returned to John's home state of Illinois and welcomed their son, John III. But John was not dad of the year. Oh, not even close. Because the same year, just months after his son was born, John packed up everything and moved to Hollywood, leaving behind his infant son and his wife. She filed for divorce under the grounds of desertion, which, fair. And in hindsight, given how he treats women later on, honestly, maybe this was the best thing that could have happened to her and his son. John was bright-eyed and enchanted by Hollywood, wanting to be part of the who's who. He quickly married an actress named Helen Gilbert, but she saw through John and left him just a few months later. When John first set out for Hollywood, maybe he thought he would break out into the Hollywood acting scene, but his life took a very different path. From the outside, he was a shop owner, selling pottery and bits of artwork. But that was just a cover for the connections that John was actually making in Hollywood. You see, in the 1950s, it was a time when Hollywood was all sparkles and starlets and glam on the surface. It was also riddled with corruption just beneath. The mafia wasn't just running bootlegging and gambling. They had their hands deep in the film industry. Studios even had their own fixers, guys whose entire job was to make problems, legal or otherwise, disappear. Basically, they all had their own Olivia Popes, if she was part of the mob. One such man was Mickey Cohen. He started off pursuing a professional boxing career, but ended up becoming a hitman for the mob and climbed his way up to be the head of the Cohen crime family. Mickey Cohen was no joke. He had worked in Chicago during the Prohibition, had run-ins even with Al Capone, and was arrested for multiple gang-related deaths. He didn't serve much time, as is the case for many, and once he got out, he wanted to go west, helping boss Benjamin Bugsy Siegel set up the Flamingo Hotel in Las Vegas. However, years later, when an order to murder Siegel for skimming off the profits at the Flamingo Hotel was carried out, Mickey knew it was probably time for him to hit the road too, and off he went to Los Angeles, where he became the crime boss that we know him to be in this story. And I really need to cover more mob stories because Mickey Cohen ended up living a very interesting life. But that's for another time. Somehow Mickey got introduced to John, and at the time, after multiple attempts on Mickey's life, he was growing a bit paranoid, and he hired John to be his bodyguard, of sorts. In reality, he was more of an errand boy most of the time. When John was first arrested for his involvement in the crime family, he was driving a Cadillac and had $33,657 in checks on him. Like, who carries that much money? That is almost $500,000 in today's money. Not suspicious at all for the owner of a pottery and, like, gift shop? I don't think he's pulling in that kind of profit. At some point while working for the Cohen family, John went from John Stompinato to Johnny Stomp, which is quite a choice for a mob name. And funny enough, on a total ADHD rabbit hole of researching, if you go to the mobmuseum.org website, it will have you answer some questions to get your own mob nickname. Mine is Elise the Shiv Delbomb. So if you do yours, put it in the comments, please. But back to the story. Johnny Stomp, now that he's called that, may not have been more than a wannabe gangster with a horrible nickname, but working in close proximity to the movers and shakers in Hollywood's underground really allowed him to hobnob with the who's who of A-list Hollywood stars, and that is where our two characters are about to collide. In January 1957, Lana Turner had finalized her divorce from Lex Barker, the man her daughter had said abused her, and began filming a rom-com with Paramount Pictures. At some point in time, whether it was at a party or just from seeing her in movies, Lana must have caught John's eye. And who could blame him? I don't know if you guys are familiar with Lana Turner, but do yourself a favor and Google her. She is unbelievably beautiful and was beautiful throughout her entire life. She's breathtaking. However, Lana never knew how John got her number, but all of a sudden, during filming this new movie, she began receiving phone calls on set and tons of flowers and gifts, all from John. This time, he ditched his poorly chosen mob name and called himself John Steele. If I were to guess, as much as Lana loved love, she was probably feeling a bit jaded after being with Lex. So she ignored John's advances for a while, but he didn't give up. And over time and many, many gifts to win her favor, Lana kind of was curious. And she said yes to a date. John never let on who he really was and his criminal history. To Lana, he was just a maybe overzealous, but sweet man named John Steele.
What was it you saw in him that you thought at the time you needed?
Well, again, I had never known such generosity. And I was intrigued. Now, this before I found out who he was.
Sure. This is when you thought he was
John Steele. And a dear, more thoughtful, considerate gentleman I had not met. And he really, truly wooed me. And I was just overwhelmed.
But once John got the object of his desire, it was not long until the nice guy facade would fall. Their relationship quickly became abusive. Lana said that he was violent towards her, but as is often the case in abusive relationships, His apologies would flood in, the promises that it will never happen again, and they'd reconcile and the pattern would just continue. At some point, Lana claimed that he even drugged her, and while she was unconscious, he took nude photos of her. And this is the point that I wish someone could have shaken Lana and said, hey, you had hard and fast boundaries when someone abused your daughter. We need to have some hard nose when it comes to you as well and how people treat you, because that is despicable. Maybe John wanted to use this as a way of blackmailing her if she ever tried to leave him. We may never know what his intent was, but the fact that he could do this and call it love is vile. In September the same year, their relationship continued on this abusive roller coaster, but duty called and Lana left to London to film a new movie. John and his fragile ego could not handle the thought of Lana filming a romantic movie with another man. A man that, frankly, I think most men would be jealous of, because Lana's co-star in this movie was a young Sir Sean Connery. Like, Sean Connery. Ugh, James Bond, like that Sean Connery, whose voice alone makes my clothes want to fall off. So, okay, I get the jealousy here, because, whew, Sean Connery. Whew. But did John just pout at home like a normal person? No. What does he do? He flew, uninvited, to London to be with Lana. Not only that, what is reported to have happened next is straight out of a movie. A James Bond movie. Now, ladies, hold on to your pantaloons, because I want you to picture this. Lana and Sean Connery are on set, gazing into each other's eyes, doing what they are paid to do, and this jealous, insecure man, uninvited, again, bursts onto the set and pulls out a gun, yelling at Lana, getting into Sean Connery's face. He even choked Lana at one point. And Sir Sean Connery, former bodybuilder, black belt in karate, and future James Bond himself, does some sort of maneuver to bend John's hand back when his gun is in his face, forced John to drop the gun, and got John off the set. Now, some say John was also knocked unconscious, but either way, ladies, I think we can all agree, all together now. Aww. The authorities were called and John was deported back to the U.S. Sean Connery is our hero. Now, I'm not going to talk about some things he did later in life, but at this moment in time, Sean Connery is our hero. Him and Lana fall in love and our story is over. Well, wouldn't that have been wonderful? But instead, when filming wrapped, Lana decided to take some time away to collect herself and rest in Acapulco, Mexico. She had kept the vacation private, not even telling the studios where she was going. But when she landed, she was met with not only the press, but guess who? John Stomp, or I guess he's going by John Steele now. In hindsight, Lana believes he was the one that had alerted the press, making sure, at least in the public eye, that they were every bit the happy couple. In Lana's words, he proved over and over that he had the power to do anything he wanted. While in Mexico, Lana, who had just found out through a friend who John Steele really was, told him that she is not going to be seen in public with him again. It would absolutely ruin her reputation. And you can just about imagine how that went over. But she stuck to her word, and on the evening of March 26, 1958, Lana, who was nominated for Best Actress, attended the Academy Awards with her daughter and mom by her side. While Lana didn't take home the award that evening, her daughter Cheryl remembers it being a magical night. She even got a chance to dance with Sean Connery, which, oh, could you imagine as a teenage girl? Anyway, the night was amazing, until John caught up with Lana after the event at the Beverly Hills Hotel. John violently abused Lana that night, and Cheryl overheard it all.
When my friend came to me and told me, hey, wait a minute, here's who this guy is, I was too deep into it then, when that's when I tried to break it off. Because I didn't want anything to do with a mobster, a gangster, or anyone of that ilk.
Did you think you loved him at the time you found out?
I was intrigued with him. Not so much love as fascinated with him. But I hadn't seen his dark side yet.
How deep are the scars that remain from that era?
A great many. It's something I'll never, never be able to forget.
A few days later, on April 4th, Lana had finally had enough. She'd had enough of his lies and the fights and the abuse, and she told Cheryl, I'm going to end it with him tonight, baby. It's going to be a rough night. Are you prepared for it? Interesting words. What did she mean by that? Did she mean for Cheryl not to be concerned if she heard them arguing? Or did it hint at something else? Something pre-planned. That night, John arrived at Lana Turner's home, and basically right away, an argument broke out between them because Lana told John she was done. She's done with the relationship and she's done with him. She wanted him out. She brought up his many lies, even the fact that she had recently found out that not only was he not John Steele, but John Stompanato, a gangster, but that he had even lied about his age. John was 32, not the 41 years he claimed to be, to perhaps be seen as more of a suitable partner to the 38-year-old actress. And the couple continued to fight. It went on and on. And Cheryl was just sitting outside the bedroom door listening to it all. I think it's important to hear the rest of what happened that night from Lana's own testimony, or I guess at least the account of her testimony, because newspapers at this time like to add a bit of flair. Quote, "I was just finding out too many lies, and this was just one more that I'd found out. It wasn't the worst lie, but it was one that no matter what made me say to him that I can't go on like this. He knew that I have begged. I have pleaded for him to leave me alone. Even with all the threats, which I admit, I had a great fear of him. Mr. Stompanato and I went back upstairs to my bedroom, both of us talking at once, him more violently. All I kept saying was, there's no use discussing it any further. I can't go on like this, and I want you to leave me alone. He grabbed me by the arm and started shaking me and cursing me very badly, and saying that as he had told me before, no matter what I did, how I tried to get away, he was never going to leave me. That if he said jump, I would jump. If he said hop, I would hop. And I would have to do anything and everything he told me to, or he'd cut my face or cripple me. And if, well, when it went beyond that, he would kill me and my daughter and my mother. He said no matter what, he would get me where it would hurt me the most, and that would be my daughter and my mom. I broke away from him and I turned around to face the door and my daughter was just standing there and I said, please, Cheryl, please don't listen to any of this. Please just go back to your room. She looked at me and I think that it was as if to say, are you sure, mother? Because I know that I repeated it and I begged her. I said, please, Cheryl, don't listen to this. Lana then closed the door and turned to John and said, that's just great. My child had to hear all of this. I can't go through this anymore. Lana said John then went to the closet to get his shirt and a jacket that were hanging there. Then, quote, he walked back to me and was holding the jacket on the hanger in a way in which he was going to strike me with it. And I said, don't you ever touch me again. I'm absolutely finished. This is the end and I want you to get out. I was walking toward the bedroom door and he was right behind me. I opened it and my daughter came in. I swear it was all so fast. I truthfully thought she just hit him in the stomach. The best I can remember, they came together and then they parted. I never saw a blade. Putting her hands to her stomach, Lana said, Mr. Stompanato grabbed himself here and he started to move forward and he almost made a half turn and then dropped on his back. And when he dropped, his arms went out so that I still did not see that there was blood or a wound until I ran over to him. And I saw his sweater was cut and I lifted the sweater up and I saw the wound. I remember only barely hearing my daughter sobbing and I ran into my bathroom and I grabbed a towel. I didn't know what to do. And then I put the towel there and Mr. Stompanato was making very dreadful sounds in his throat of gasping, just terrible sounds. And I went to the telephone and I called my mother because I had been out of the country for so long, I couldn't even remember my doctor's number. I kept trying to talk to him, slapping his cheeks, calling his name, and he just kept making these horrible noises. All the while, Lana said that she was trying to reassure her hysterical daughter that everything would be all right. Apparently, in all this chaos, Cheryl had called her dad saying, Daddy, please come quick. Something terrible has happened. Cheryl's father, Steve Crane, and the doctor who had been called by Lana's mother arrived around the same time. The doctor saw the seriousness of the situation and administered two shots of adrenaline in a desperate attempt to start John's quiet heart. Lana Turner and her mother, who showed up just minutes later, tried to breathe life into, and remember, these are the LA Times words, not mine. They tried to breathe life into the fallen hoodlum's mouth. Finally, the doctor told Miss Turner to call an inhalator squad and an ambulance. If you're wondering what the heck an inhalator squad is, I was too. I guess at the time, there was a team of first responders that had something called a lungometer, which apparently was meant to help people in respiratory distress by forcing pressurized oxygen into the lungs. That team that had that device was called the Inhalator Squad. Anyways, back to that night. Lana was so panicked that she could not even speak into the phone after dialing the number and the doctor had to take over. The police, headed by Chief Anderson, the ambulance crew, and the inhalator crew all showed up to Lana's house. When the chief approached Lana, she apparently asked him, "Can't I just take the blame for this?" Of course, he told her, "No, we can't do that. We just have to get the facts." John Stompanato passed away at the scene. He had been stabbed with an 8-inch blade. It went through his abdomen, kidney, and aorta all the way to his backbone. 14-year-old Cheryl Turner had killed him. And as you can imagine, the press had a field day with this. One of the top actresses of the generation, her 14-year-old daughter had killed a man in her mother's pink Beverly Hills bedroom. The headlines wrote themselves. And reporters literally set up camp, I'm talking tents, on Lana's lawn. On April 11th, when Lana was set to testify at the coroner's inquest, 100 journalists and cameramen crammed into the tiny courtroom to get a glimpse of Lana taking the stand. It was a media spectacle made even more sensational by the witnesses that they brought to the stand. Of course, this included Lana, her mom, who ended up being too emotional that she couldn't even speak and was removed. But they decided in a weird choice to bring mob boss Mickey Cohen himself. Why they called him to the stand, I have no clue. First of all, in what could have been a power move, he showed up late. Then he rushes to the witness stand, and when he was asked whether he had identified the body of John Stompanato, Mickey Cohen snaps at the guy. He says, "I refuse to identify the body. I refuse to identify him as John Stompanato Jr. on the grounds that I may have been accused of this murder," which, I mean, fair. He was a mob boss, but why did he even need to go to court just to say that? A man called Steven, who apparently was a friend of John's, rushed into the courtroom and through the crowds of photographers and shouted, "I want to testify. It's all a lie. The girl was in love with him. There was jealousy between her and her mother. He's a gentleman. That's more than I can say about the rest of you Hollywood people." He was quickly removed from the courtroom, as you can imagine. The room grew silent when a tearful Lana Turner took the stand. She removed one glove so that she could wipe her tears as she began her 62-minute testimony. What I read you earlier was the majority of that testimony, and it didn't take me 62 minutes, so you can imagine how emotional she was on the stand, often having to pause, wipe away tears, and collect herself. A testimony that was so emotional and so impactful that a columnist for the New York Daily News described it as, "Lana Turner played the most dramatic and effective role of her long screen career here today at the coroner's inquest." All in all, the inquest lasted 4 hours, and after just 25 minutes of deliberation, the coroner's jury unanimously ruled that it had been a justifiable homicide. So what now? A man is dead, a Hollywood starlet is at the center of a media firestorm, and a 14-year-old girl is a murderer. I mean, a justified murderer, says the coroner's jury. That's the story that we know. But as soon as the news of the jury's ruling broke, the whispers started. Was it really Cheryl, or was this just a well-rehearsed performance from one of Hollywood's greatest actresses? As for Lana's dramatic testimony on the stand, Cheryl, who was not present at the inquest because she was a minor, she later addressed the speculation head-on. "My mom wasn't acting. She was terrified. I know my mother. She was fighting for her child. I have been asked this question hundreds of times. Didn't your mother do it? Isn't she the one who really killed him? But no, I killed John Stompanato. I didn't do it to cover for my mother. To make your child live their life knowing that they've taken someone else's, that's unthinkable. Who would do that? Not my mother, not the mother I knew." Many who believe Lana was the real killer and that Cheryl took the blame point to the murder weapon as the strongest piece of evidence for their theory. If the events unfolded exactly as Lana and Cheryl described, then why was the knife moved from the bedroom to the bathroom? Why was the handle wiped clean, leaving only one smudged, unidentifiable print? Lana later admitted to moving the knife, but couldn't recall why. And people act unpredictably in shock, and some speculate that her instinct was to protect her daughter. Perhaps she wiped away the evidence before she fully processed what had happened. When the police showed up, she even asked the chief officer if she could take the blame herself. Was this a mother's desperate act of protecting her child, or was it something more calculated? Years later, new claims emerged that cast even more doubt on Lana's version of events. A hairdresser of Lana's came forward and wrote in his book that while doing Lana's hair at the Plaza Hotel 3 years after John's death, a television show referenced the case, and her hairdresser claimed that Lana blurted out, "I killed the son of a bitch and I would do it again." But Cheryl said that he was just fabricating that to sell a book. A stylist at MGM also recalled an eerie exchange in his memoir as well. The morning of John's murder, he had run into Lana leaving a hardware store in Beverly Hills. When he asked what the heck Lana Turner was doing at a hardware store, she responded, "We needed a new knife." The next day, after John's death, the stylist visited Lana again. This time, he said she collapsed into his arms, sobbing, and whispered, "Did you ever dream this could happen? And with the very knife I bought yesterday." Lana told a slightly different story in her autobiography. She said that her and John had gone shopping together earlier that week, and yes, the knife that he was stabbed with was one of the knives that he had purchased, but it was not bought with any sinister intent. And there was even more twisted rumors that circulated that I won't go into too much detail, but basically that John and Cheryl had become involved in a relationship, and that Lana came into her home, found them in bed together. And here's the thing. If I was a mom, I'm not, but if I was, and I saw a 32-year-old man who I thought was 41 in bed with my 14-year-old daughter, that also sounds like justifiable homicide. But then there's a theory that it wasn't just a crime of passion, that it was Lana's attempt to stop a much bigger plan all set in motion by the mob. According to some sources, John Stompanato wasn't just Lana Turner's abusive boyfriend. He was a man on a mission, handpicked by Mickey Cohen to get close to Lana, gain her trust, and obtain something that the mob could use to leverage against her. And what better weapon than blackmail? In her memoir, Remember, Lana herself revealed that John had drugged her and taken explicit photos without her consent. And if that's true, what else might he have been planning? Some believe he was under orders to go even further, to secretly record an intimate moment with Lana, footage that would be used to control her, or even the powerful studios that were backing her career. So then the question becomes, did Lana find out about this plan? And if she did, was John really the only threat in the room that night? If you're curious to know what I think happened in this case, sometimes facts are stranger than fiction. And I get that these theories add layers of drama and intrigue to an already crazy story. As I researched this case, I found myself double-checking sources just to be sure I hadn't accidentally stumbled on one of Lana's scripts instead of the factual account of what happened. I mean, come on. James Bond swoops in to fight her abusive boyfriend. Her 14-year-old daughter delivers the final fatal blow. It sounds all far-fetched, so I get why people came up with lots of theories. But this is where I want to go back to what I told you about Cheryl's story, her childhood, her trauma, because that part matters. Cheryl grew up in a way that many of us will never understand. She was incredibly privileged. Yes, no doubt about it. But even by her own admission, she had a really lonely childhood. And at just 10 years old, she wasn't just lonely, she was terrified. She had endured violent assaults in the one place that she should have felt safe. Then her mother, a bit absent most of her life, swoops in, comes to the rescue, putting a gun to her husband's head and demanding him out of their home, threatening to run him over if he didn't remove his hands from the steering wheel. Right or wrong, that moment could have imprinted something deep in Cheryl's mind, that violence could stop violence. A gun to the head would make the bad man go away. Being dragged on the asphalt for a bit would make sure that he never returned. So when she heard the same man, the same man who had just a few nights before ruined their sparkly Academy Award evening with his rage, he was screaming and threatening her mom once again. Is it really that unthinkable that a 14-year-old girl, shaped by all the trauma of her past, reacted in the only way that she knew how and that she had been shown? That as the shouting continued behind her mother's bedroom door, as fear was just gripping her of what was going to happen next, she ran to the kitchen, got a knife, and with the reckless desperation of a child, did the only thing that had ever made the bad man go away. But I wasn't there that night, so tell me, what do you think the real story is? Leave it in the comments, send me a DM, I actually really want to hear your theories. While John's story ended that fateful night, Lana and Cheryl's journeys were far from over. Lana Turner returned to the screen, and she returned to the wedding chapel a few more times. All in all, Lana Turner would marry 8 times to 7 men, because remember, she married Cheryl's dad twice, one illegally, so I'm not sure if it counts. She also toned down her partying ways as the years passed. Sadly, after long nights of flowing drinks and cigarettes smoked in dimly lit Hollywood nightclubs, it all caught up with her. Lana Turner ended up passing away June 29, 1995, at the age of 74, from a 3-year battle with throat cancer.
How would you like Lana Turner to be remembered? Not the public Lana Turner that we know about, but that private one you're talking about that has her private moments at home. And
as a true Roman, a woman who has lived, who has been through many fires, survived them, when we can laugh at herself, who can even laugh at this cockeyed world that we're so mixed up in, but always with a prayer behind the laughter. We have to survive. I survived it, and I'm a far better person for it.
As for Lana's daughter, Cheryl, she understandably struggled with the aftermath of that tragic night. She had her highs and lows, working as a model for a while, and later in her father's restaurant. But it was Marlon Brando, of all people, who introduced Cheryl to Joyce LeRoy, a female model who would become her life partner. The two settled in California, where Cheryl wrote several books, including her own memoir, Detour, A Hollywood Story, and a book about her mother's life, and a few fictional works as well. In 2014, a year after California legalized gay marriage, and after more than 4 decades together, Cheryl married Joyce and they slipped away from the public eye to live a quieter life. And with that, my friends, we have come to the end of today's case. As always, don't forget to rate, review, subscribe, and of course, I really want to hear your theories on today's story. Before I go, though, I want to share a quote from Lana Turner herself. It's one that I think not only sums up her life, but also something worth holding on to when things get tough in yours. The thing about happiness is that it doesn't help you grow. Only unhappiness does that. So I'm grateful that my bed of roses was made equally of blossoms and thorns. I've had a privileged, creative, exciting life, and I think that the parts that were less joyous were preparing me, testing me, and strengthening me. I will see you all for a new case soon, but as always, until then.